May it please the court. When the lower court applied the Gardner analytical framework to the facts of this case, did it abuse its discretion in finding that there were not circumstances to support a sua sponte alibi instruction? We suggest there was abuse of discretion in a number of respects. First, there was an abuse of discretion in the evaluation of whether there was the alibi defense was a main defense, one of the criteria of Gardner. There is no, the defense counsel never explicitly said that the main defense is identification and that a lesser defense is alibi. I suggest that the court couldn't make that, the lower court couldn't make that the determination. Basically, it seemed like it looked at the number, you know, the amount of time spent on each defense.
Is your claim before us is one of plain error by the trial judge, is that correct?
Yes.
Do we have before us an ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
It's ineffective assistance of counsel and that there was plain error. There's two components of the claim. The lower court found cause for the procedural default because of the manifest injustice prong of Rule 61. And so I think either way we have to address the procedural default. The lower court addressed it, found that there was a basis to establish that there was a viable claim under Rule 61. It really focused on the prejudice prong of it.
The plain error claim could have been raised on a direct appeal?
Yes.
Okay. And what is the relief from that procedural default?
Well, cause for the procedural default is for ineffective assistance of counsel, of trial counsel and appellate counsel.
I recall the trial judge addressed where the trial counsel may, as a matter of strategy, made some choices. But there's no focus on appellate counsel, not raising the plain error.
Well, there was speculation by the lower court that trial counsel may have, as a matter of strategy, declined to proceed in that way. I suggest there's no record of that, and there's no record that he actually was aware of the law under Gardner, that it's required in certain circumstances.
Now, is it a constitutional violation that provides the relief from the procedural default or manifest injustice? What is it that you're relying on? And what is, if it's a constitutional violation, what is the constitutional violation?
It's the constitutional violation is a violation of the right to a fair trial, a right to have jury instructions that accurately instruct the jury on the law applicable in the case, the right to present a defense, all under the due process umbrella.
All right. Help me understand. In Flamer, we found Flamer versus State. We found that there was no cause that excused the procedural default for failure to raise an Edwards claim, and because it could have been raised on direct appeal and wasn't. Why doesn't that control here, Flamer?
Well, the law in Gardner is so clear. The principle that a defendant is entitled to proper instructions relating to his defense so that the jury can properly evaluate that defense, I think goes to the core of a person's due process right. And for...
So does that, just so I understand the scope of this exception, are you arguing that in every criminal conviction that has been, where someone is still basically subject to the sentence, that they can now challenge under Rule 61 the failure to give an instruction because of a due process right to have an accurate statement of the law?
Well, I think I'm getting diverted, because this is really the issue in front of Judge Cooch was whether he had a sua sponte duty to issue the alibi instruction. And he found that under Rule 61, cause for that the procedural default was under the miscarriage of justice prong. So while I addressed ineffective assistance of counsel in my brief, really the primary basis for overcoming the cause portion of Rule 61 is the miscarriage of justice.
All right.
I don't know if that... I didn't want to focus on ineffective assistance of counsel, because I don't think that's really where the lower court focused. And the issue here is, regardless of the defense attorney omission, did the judge have a duty to give the alibi instruction?
Okay. And is the primary concern the burden of proof and potential confusion over the burden of proof?
Well, how the jury is supposed to evaluate the alibi evidence, and whether the, and it's the burden of proof, the proper burden of proof, whether or not the jury understood that the defense had to convince them beyond a reasonable doubt of the truth of the alibi. Just how do you evaluate that? And I think Gardner establishes that it's not that it should be given under certain circumstances. And it's, and Gardner did not deal with identity instruction is the functional equivalent of alibi. Therefore, the identification instruction covers this. It dealt with this has to be given under certain circumstances, and they enumerated some circumstances, but it was not an exclusive list. It was, they noted it was a suggested
Mr. Monica, in order for your position to prevail, we would have to hold, would we not, that any time an alibi defense is raised, the trial judge is required sua sponte to give an alibi instruction, whether that instruction is requested or not. Would you agree?
That's what Gardner says, I believe, Your Honor. That's what I'm our claim is asking.
You're saying Gardner holds that?
Yes. I think Gardner declares that.
Well, that the first sentence, although there is generally no duty to charge upon alibi in the absence of a specific request, it is recognized that in certain circumstances.
So. Right. This is the last sentence of that paragraph, and I don't think this leaves it up to interpretation. Thus, where a defendant offers an alibi defense by introducing substantial evidence showing that he was elsewhere when the crime was committed, the trial judge should give an alibi instruction, and the failure to do so in those circumstances, even without a request from the defendant, will be deemed plain error. I don't think that there's any room for interpretation in that last sentence.
Well, there is a qualifier in that sentence dealing which speaks of the circumstances.
Yes.
Not universal.
Yes.
So why are these circumstances, why should these circumstances count?
Well, the court said that these were suggestions. It wasn't an exclusive list. The lower court applied them. I think.
Well, you're asking us to hold that it should have been obvious to the judge that that the defendant's constitutional rights were in such jeopardy that he or she should have given the instruction, even though it wasn't obvious to defense counsel at the trial, even though it wasn't obvious to counsel who handled the direct appeal.
Your Honor, we're asking for relief under Gardner. We think that the circumstances exist that support a sua sponte alibi instruction. Now, I can't speculate as to what the trial counsel was thinking, and I'm not going to pretend to. I'm suggesting that there are circumstances, some of the circumstances as suggested by the Gardner court exist here and support and therefore support giving the alibi instructions to a sponte.
But your position rises or falls with that interpretation of Gardner.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Elizabeth McFarlane on behalf of the State. Your Honors, this is a case of an appeal from a Rule 61 motion. And the defendant has raised a plain error claim here. Plain error is not applicable in Rule 61. Plain error is applicable on direct appeal. In this case, this claim was not raised on direct appeal, and therefore plain error is not a standard applicable to this claim. The State contends that the claim is barred procedurally under...
Well, if it isn't a standard, then what is the standard?
The standard is based on the Rule 61. This would be an abuse of discretion as to whether the trial court denied the Rule 61, and it would be considering whether the facts were, findings of facts were clearly erroneous, and whether the law was correctly applied.
Well, the problem with that standard is that I think we have here by definition a circumstance where the judge didn't exercise any discretion because nobody ever asked him to do it.
The discretion would apply to Superior Court's ruling on the Rule 61, Your Honor, not to the trial court during trial. Direct appeal has passed, and this claim was not raised. Therefore, under the clear rules of Rule 61, this would be barred under 61(i)(3) unless the defendant could show cause and prejudice for failure to have raised the claim in the proceedings leading to a judgment. Here, ineffective assistance of counsel was raised as cause.
Well, I suppose the argument, if you want to frame it in terms of the structure that you suggested, is that the Rule 61 judge abused his discretion by not holding that the trial court had an obligation sua sponte to give the instruction.
Well, the State would not agree that there is an abuse of discretion, but yes, that would be the method of the framework. But certainly the State contends there was not an abuse of discretion in that.
Why not?
Because in this circumstance, first of all, the claim was not required to be given sua sponte in this case. Had defense counsel requested the instruction, he would have received the instruction at trial. The court would have been required had it been requested. However, it was not requested. Once again, on appeal, this issue was not raised. This was a very straightforward case. There were three witnesses by the State. It was a question of identification of who the shooter was. And in this case, the victim had given statements to police identifying Mr. Kellum as the shooter. When he took the stand, he recanted and said, well, yes, I did identify him as the shooter, but not because he was the shooter, but because I had a beef with him and I was trying to get even.
Well, before you dilate further on the facts, I think what we have here is an issue of how Gardner should be interpreted. And if I understand your side's position correctly, it's basically very simple. If a request for an alibi instruction is given, assuming that the defense has been raised, then the instruction has to be given to the jury.
That is correct.
If there is no request, then the judge is not required to give the instruction. The judge may or may not, but there's no requirement. Is that your
position? That is the state's position. Gardner suggests that there are circumstances where a judge would be required and gives examples that could lead to a case where it would be deemed plain error not to have done so.
Where there's no request.
Where there is no request.
Okay.
Gardner did not decide that, however, because that was not in Gardner, there were no facts that actually required any alibi instruction.
Okay, it isn't a simple black and white. There's a gray area.
Based on Gardner's dicta, which was not a holding in the case because that was not the issue. Well, they didn't reach that issue but made suggestions. But, yes, based on Gardner, there is a gray area as to when it would constitute plain error.
All right. And Mr. Monica is arguing that this case falls in that gray area.
Yes, he is. And the state would contend that it does not. And also that because we are now in post-conviction, the standard is even higher than plain error.
Why doesn't it fall in the gray area?
Because in this case, there was no prejudice to the defendant. Not only was there no confusion as to the burden, which is the issue, Gardner was concerned, and cases requiring instructions are concerned, is whether the burden is shifted and the burden of persuasion is somehow interpreted by the jury to fall on the defendant. In this case, given the instructions that were given, particularly the identification instruction, there was no confusion that it was the state's burden to prove that Mr. Kellum was the shooter and was there. In fact, in the pattern instructions, the non-statutory defenses, there's an instruction in which you could either put in alibi or identification, and the wording is identical. So based on that, and the jury had that instruction,
The word alibi was not in any of the instructions given, is that right?
That is correct.
Although alibi was argued, the word alibi appeared in the arguments.
Yes, alibi was argued, and two alibi witnesses were presented by the defense. There is no question that there was an alibi defense presented. The stronger case in defense would be to focus on the either misidentification or failure to identify the defendant. And in fact, the defendant's brother's videotaped statement in which he was shown the same photo array, including the defendant, was played for the jury, and that witness's statement was the shooter is not in there. And that was a focus of the defense as well. So this case was clearly a whodunit.
Let me get back to Gardner for a minute. That decision is some 30 years ago.
Yes.
To your knowledge, has Gardner been applied as pretty much mandatory, which seems to be what opposing counsel is suggesting, that, there are these factors, but the court is pretty emphatic in Gardner about giving an alibi defense. I'm not familiar with a whole host of cases interpreting Gardner and explaining one way or the other how necessary it is.
There have not been a string of cases applying Gardner as in the way suggested by defense counsel. There has been, in fact, very little in that area of the law, and there's been, to my knowledge, nothing that the state has seen in post-conviction standard either. So
it's pretty much Gardner on its own.
Gardner has been referenced in terms of plain error on direct appeal, but not as if it was always required by any, it has not been interpreted to have always been required. And also, this is, as Your Honor pointed out, an older case, and this case predates this court's movement toward reinforcing the party autonomy rule in Delaware. In Chao, which came a good bit later, this court has gone on to reinforce that this is party autonomy, and trial counsel's decision to ask for instructions should be left alone. And this is one of those cases that...
But again, tell me whether I had this right or not. Your position is that this case doesn't fall within the gray area created by the dictum in Gardner, because here there was no prejudice. And the reason there was no prejudice is that, at least in this case, the identification instruction was the functional equivalent of an alibi instruction.
Yes, that is correct,
That's
Your Honor.
That's your position.
Well, and even without that instruction, this case was very straightforward, and defense counsel had an opportunity to argue the alibi instruction, and the burden of proof was correctly presented to the jury. This is not a question where the law, the correct law, was not provided to the jury. It was, including the standard of proof. And this is also not a case where there was any potential argument in closing, either by the state or by defense counsel, that muddied the waters. The state's argument included, you know, it is the state's burden to prove every element. So this was not a case that was really a close call in the sense of correctly instructing the jury. They had all the information they needed to properly evaluate the claim.
Well, there's an argument that can be made that identification and alibi are really not the same. And the Ninth Circuit says an alibi defense differs from other mistaken identity defenses in an important respect. A defendant might win based on an alibi defense even if she does nothing at all to dispute the government's proof, because the alibi itself can create reasonable doubt. And without an alibi, the defendant would have to work much harder to disprove identity. What I'd like to ask you is, in Brown, where we reversed for failure to give an alibi instruction when it was requested, the court said, without an alibi instruction in this case, the jury was erroneously left free to assume that the defendant bore the burden of proving alibi. Now, why isn't that the circumstance here?
Because here, the jury was instructed specifically that you must be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant has been accurately identified and that the defendant was indeed the one that did the act charged, meaning you have to find beyond a reasonable doubt that he was there to shoot him. If there is any reasonable doubt about his identification, you must give him the benefit of such doubt. Those words clearly direct the jury to consider whether there was enough proof to establish he was there. Whether or not, in fact, it gave no burden to the defense to raise a reasonable doubt level of alibi. All they had to do was put in some doubt that would prevent reasonable doubt. I'm sorry, that would create a reasonable doubt here.
Was there any argument to the jury on who had to prove alibi?
No.
Was there argument on who had to prove identification?
I'm not exactly sure. The state certainly argued about the identification, and defense argued at length about identification and the failure of the state to prove it because the witness had, in fact, recanted. So in that sense, yes, that was argued. I don't think it was specifically argued the way that you framed that question, however. Although there was certainly argument about whether it was likely that the recanting witness had, why he had recanted, or the credibility in the state. It was clear that this case hinged on the identification by the victim. that was really the only evidence of the state that placed Mr. Kellum at the scene.
Would it be fair to say that under the facts of this case, identification and alibi were actually mixed together in the sense that there could be a case where the defendant doesn't really say much of anything about the witnesses who say, I recognize this person as having been the perpetrator, but instead the defendant says, well, here are my seven witnesses who show that I was at a movie and I have my movie ticket and I have all these other things to show that I have an alibi. As opposed to that kind of situation, if I understand the facts correctly, this was a case where the alibi was part of why the identification was wrong.
That's correct. It was very mixed together. And this is clearly very different than a case where the state had, for example, a non-recanting witness that they put up and said, that was the shooter, he was there, I saw him, and the defense would put up a witness saying, he was with me, he couldn't have been him, he was over there. That is not this case. This case is a recanting witness, and by the way, the reason you should believe his new version over his prior statements to police is because now I have an alibi. That would be different, a very different case, the state contends, and that would possibly be a case where an alibi instruction would be much more significant to the defense. Here also, the trial court found that there was not substantial evidence of the alibi given the alibi witnesses' testimony and the fact that they had actually discussed developing where the defendant was during that time. They had discussed it. They had watched these others' testimony, and they had credibility problems. And the Superior Court found that that there was no substantial alibi that in this case.
Well, that's like granting summary judgment on a defense, isn't it?
This was just in relation to whether an alibi instruction would have been required.
In other words, tell me if I have this right, you're suggesting that the court made a finding that there wasn't enough evidence to justify giving an alibi defense in any case, even if it had been requested?
No, the court did not make that finding because the court agreed that at trial, all you would need would be some credible evidence, sworn testimony would. But
so
in Gardner,
what is the legal significance of your point?
In Gardner, the court said that if there was substantial evidence, then that would be more likely to be plain error if there were no instruction.
So it responds.
It's a higher standard.
Responds to one of the data points in the so-called gray area.
Yes. If the court has no further questions,
thank you.
Thank you.
Gardner's 30 years old, but I suggest it should be followed. It doesn't state anything radical. It basically follows the premise that the jury should be correctly instructed on the law applicable in the case, and in this particular case, the defense of alibi, which was raised, which this court recognized in its opinion on direct appeal, that there was an alibi defense. The only thing that Gardner really suggests anew is that it made suggestions on what the criteria may be. But that it should be that the court should issue it sua sponte, it just follows the principle of making sure that the jury understands what the law is when they are going to make decisions in these type of cases. On the point of whether the lower court committed legal error or abused its discretion on the whether there was substantial evidence of the alibi, I suggest there was legal error in the way it determined that that it has to be substantial evidence that it is more than some credible evidence, and it's abuse of discretion if it's a higher standard than some credible evidence, to find that to completely disregard the evidence of alibi by pointing to convictions, family relationships, I suggest, like a summary judgment motion, that type of evidence in this setting should be looked at in the light most favorable to the defense. Once it reaches some credible evidence, that meets the test. I think this court committed, or the lower court committed, legal error by making credibility assessments on its own on this issue. If that was the case, that the jury should not have considered it because there was no credible evidence on that, then it wouldn't have been permitted to be considered by the jury.
Let's rewind the clock. Let's assume we're on direct appeal.
Yes.
And it had been argued, and it is being argued, that it's plain error not to give the instruction.
Yes.
Why would it not be appropriate to conclude that it might be error, but it's not plain error because of the instruction given on burden of proof?
The plain error is that there, when a jury is not properly instructed on this defense, the burden issues can be misinterpreted, and the jury can be misled on the proper burden of proof, and create confusion, and they're not properly instructed on how to evaluate that evidence.
So you're saying that if it's error, it has to be plain error.
Well, I think it when
that
when,
is there is you can't make the fine distinction between error and plain error in these circumstances.
I think when a jury is not properly instructed on a
I'm sorry,
key legal
is that
principle,
a yes or a no?
Yes. The state also makes the point that it's the defense counsel's discretion to make a choice. But in this case, as an example, the defendant did not want the lesser included instruction, and that was imposed upon defense in this case, even over its objection. So it's not like it's whatever the defense counsel wants. In this case, it was important to instruct the jury on this important legal concept. And I just want to repeat and reemphasize that identification is not the functional equivalent of alibi.
How could it not be mixed? As counsel for the state observed in response to Justice Berger's question, that is to say, the reason that the identification has to be wrong is that the defendant wasn't there.
Well, they're related, but identification deals with how you evaluate evidence that a person was at the scene and committed the crime. Alibi is how do you evaluate the suggestion that the person didn't commit the crime because he wasn't at that location?
They may be legally separate defenses, but they're logically and psychologically connected, are they not?
Logically and yes, but you know, I keep wanting, you know, hoping to focus back on the Gardner, where the Gardner court did not recognize that they were functionally equivalent.
Didn't address that at all.
Well, they didn't address it, but identification instruction certainly existed back then, and certainly since that existed, if that was an issue, they certainly could have reached the conclusion that the identification instruction would have covered this issue, as the state and as the lower court, you know, found. It didn't. And I think it's significant that in certain circumstances, it made it clear that it would, it's required, the trial court's required to give that instruction.
Why shouldn't we accept the rule as it exists in Georgia under Herring versus State? And this is a quotation from the Georgia Supreme Court, 1977. Where the defense of alibi and the question of personal identity are virtually the same defense, the omission of the court to instruct separately on alibi is not error. The trial judge did not charge on the law, or strike that. The trial judge did charge on the law of identification, hence the omission of the court to instruct separately on alibi without request did not affect the outcome of the case and was not error.
Well, Your Honor, read the quote from the Ninth Circuit in, explaining the significance of the alibi instruction, and that's a famous quote that relates to this issue. I think that quote really highlights the distinction. In a defendant can win on alibi even if the defendant doesn't dispute the state's evidence in a on identification. If an alibi defense can give reasonable doubt, and you can win just on that, regardless of the state's evidence on identification. They're separate.
Well, implicit in an alibi defense is a dispute of the identification, isn't there?
Yes, but there is still a distinction. There's still a different focus. And as lawyers, we understand that. The jury may not. I think that the jury has to understand the burden. The jury has to understand that an alibi can create reasonable doubt regardless of the state's evidence on identification. And I think that's what Gardner establishes. In the end, we're just asking for the court to follow Gardner, and we're suggesting that the lower court abuse its discretion in its application of certain of those criteria in finding that there was no prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take this matter under advisement and take a brief recess.